song I want to hear right now. No stage dives. I'm not particularly in the best mood. If I could talk to you guys seriously for a couple of minutes, I'd super appreciate it. There's two people who aren't here today, and one has a very legitimate reason as to not be here, and that's the name I want to hear chanted. His name is John Moxley. I'll spend all my time out here listening to you guys chant for him right now because it's important. It's important to me. I have some history with John Moxley. We're not super tight. We're not the best of friends. But, you know, last night I'm traveling here in a car. I got Larry riding shotgun and I get a phone call. And I have this situation explained to me. And I know what it's like to go and think you have to be so tough and better than everybody else and wrap up injuries and be sick and show up to work and do all these things that get compounded and help other people and be super generous and eventually get to a point where you have to take yourself off the hamster wheel. And I've been criticized for it. I don't want anybody to criticize John Moxley because I am goddamn proud of him. And I'll say one last thing about it. If anybody here, anybody at home watching on television, if you're in a place where you think you need help, get it. Ask for it. Reach out. Text somebody. Call somebody. There's nothing harder that you can do in the world, but there's nothing more courageous as well. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. Hell, there's been plenty of times in my life and career that I wish I asked for help, and I didn't, because I thought I was being a tough guy.
John Moxley entering inpatient alcohol treatment program. Obviously, we wish the best to him and Renee and their child, and hopefully this turns out for the best for everybody.
It's going to be tough for him because he's, you know, he's a guy where alcohol has been, you know, like just like you go out and hang out with the guys and drink, you know. I mean, he's a drinker. And I guess that he, for whatever reason, it came to a halt and he just, for, you know, decided this is it. And it's going to be tough because it's like it's such a big part of him doing that.
You know, this story just kind of, I would say, maybe came out of nowhere, and the timing of which is really interesting considering his book released on the same day. And from the snippets I've seen, I mean, you know, having a celebratory drink seems like it's, you know, just sort of a way of life for John Moxley, and maybe sometimes not necessarily celebratory, but I guess the severity of this actually escalating to become an issue, I think, was at least news to me and maybe to several fans as well. You know, the man being as active and as entertaining and as functional as he seems to be on TV. But knowing how much he loves this business, knowing how much he loves to perform, knowing how much, you know, he's willing to put his body through to get to the show, for him to have to take this time off, I think exactly tells you how severe this problem might have gotten in his personal life.
It, you know, it was very courageous to go and do that right now, because there's always a situation where the company's counting on you. And in this case, you know, and they were, you know, the company's counting on you.
And I think giving others kind of the signal that this is the way that someone, they should not feel embarrassed or nervous about addressing these problems. I think this is an industry that unfortunately has way too many tales of individuals that either ignored their problems for too long, put them to the side, was always focused on the next show, the next angle, the next program, that it was always I'll deal with this at another time, and those issues compound.
Everything that you are taught in these situations in wrestling is that, you know, you owe it to the fans, you owe it to the boys in the back, you owe it to the company that pays you a lot of money, and especially when you're on top and you're a top guy, and you've got to perform and everything like that. So to walk away from that it goes against everything that you were taught. I mean, one good thing is that we have learned, I think, in the last couple of years, or wrestling has accepted things like mental health and alcoholism in a much more positive manner. You know, before, I mean, I can just remember with, you know, going back a generation with Brian Pillman, with his Rehab is for Losers t-shirt, nipped his
issues. It was Rehab is for Quitters.
Quitters.
Yes.
And, you know, and that was the mentality that these guys had.
You know, if it was a different time, I don't know if he would be as willing to, you know, take that time off.
Guys in that situation would just keep it quiet. But hopefully, the fact that he would go in, nobody forced him in, as far as I know, happened at a time when he had all of these things going on. And
yeah, like a lot of shit was happening at once, like because we were getting ready to move. So we're dealing with all that. I was trying to sell a house, trying to buy a house, dealing with a bunch of crap. And the whole time it's getting really bad. And I'm just trying to stay level, you know.
We have a 4-month baby.
Yeah, oh, yeah, we just had a baby. And I'm like, that's when I first tried to stop, you know, before she even came. And then that just made it worse. Like, and so, yeah, you can't be drunk when you're holding the baby. You know? So it was like obvious before the baby even got here that I was like, you gotta fucking stop drinking. Like, it was just a lot harder to do. It's like going 12 rounds with a boxer who's just kicking your ass for 12 rounds every day. And you just keep going back and he just keeps whooping your ass again, you know, and you're not gonna win because you can't, you physically can't. It's just gonna keep whooping your ass. It's exhausting. So the way I looked at it was, I'm changing my strategy. I'm not tapping out. I'm just coming off the stool in the next round with a different strategy. Now we're going to go to rehab.
Yeah.
And now this is how I'm going to win this fight. And I did. I just had to completely, I couldn't do it alone.
Yeah.
You know, so I looked at it like that. You know, like if you're losing the battle, sometimes you need to change the weapon or the strategy you're fighting the battle with. You know, so I went with a different weapon was how I looked at it.
You know, I mean, the fact that he went tells you that he saw something and he knew that something was bad was about to happen, or presumed that, and wanted to, you know, take care of it.
I wanted to stop drinking for a long time. I was trying to quit drinking for a long time. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. I was trying for the longest time, which sounds stupid. If you don't know, you just go, just stop drinking. Here's the thing, too, that I didn't really know until I started dealing with this. If you just stop drinking, you can die. At some point, especially the first time I tried to stop, and I was experiencing alcohol withdrawal. Yeah, just quitting drinking cold turkey, you know, at a certain threshold, which I was at, it's the worst thing you can do. It's the most dangerous thing you can do. You can just go into cardiac arrest and die. Or what's really common is you have seizures.
Yeah.
And something really bad can happen from that. That's what happened to Cass.
Mm-hmm.
Is 12 hours without alcohol in his system, he had a seizure.
I had a few more seizures after the one in Philadelphia. After I went to rehab, I had a few more seizures later on.
These ones were in private?
Yeah, they were. Family and my girlfriend and her family, it was awful. It got to the point where I knew I was going to die. It was just a matter of if I keep going down this path, I was going to die. And you got to do something about this. I could have easily given up, but I don't know, something in some instinctual thing told me you got to keep going. And the hardest thing to do is to reach out for help.
People think this is easy. Like, people think it's just like check into a program and magically you're fixed.
Yeah, people do think it's just that easy. And to be honest with you, I'm ashamed to say this, but there was a point in time many years ago where I thought the same thing, where I didn't think I had a problem. And I just thought, yeah, it's just that easy. That, why is that person struggling, you know?
Yeah.
So I understand why some people think that, because I was one of those people many, many moons ago.
What was the breakthrough moment for you in recovery?
Finally admitting that maybe I don't know everything. Admitting that I shouldn't be in control anymore. It's either you got to do what everybody else is doing, reach out and ask them for help and do what they've done, or suffer the really, really horrible consequences. There's no other game plan.
And in this case, you're saying the horrible consequences would be not living anymore.
It's 100%. It's I talk to friends and family now, and you know, they say if they got a phone call, I'm trying not to get emotional. If they got a phone call in the morning, that they wouldn't have been surprised that I passed away, man. So it got to that point, yeah.
It wasn't like, okay, I'm all stressed out and I have problems. And like, it wasn't like, okay, I need to go to rehab and talk about my feelings. It was, I'm going to die. Like, it was a physical problem. I need to recalibrate my whole system. Like, I'm completely f***ed up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that can it can happen to anybody, man. Like, there's, 100%. I don't know what the threshold is, but like,
yeah.
Once you start feeling like that, those withdrawal symptoms, be it like alcohol or pills or whatever it is, like that's when you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. When you're like doing whatever you're doing to normalize yourself.
This Wednesday morning, my son passed. So
you told me that T had been rushed to the hospital, had what they thought was a seizure. And
ended up
that was kind of the start of it.
Yeah, the seizure caused a cardiac arrest. He was basically dead in his room on the floor with EMT working on him. And they got him back and got him in the the ambulance. And tried to save his life. And as time went on, about 1:30, 1:45 in the morning, the doctor just wanted to talk to us. Looked down at my wife and I, and he just said, "Your son's not going to make it." And I just like, and I said, "I'm not going to pull his breathing tube out." I said, "I won't do that." I said, that's not an option. I said, so what are we talking? I said, you're saying that when he had the cardiac arrest that he did damage to his heart. So that's why we can't get his bottom number up. That means the bottom ventricle had been damaged to some degree because he didn't have the ability to push blood. His top number was much higher. And even though they medically brought the top number down, he was like 111 over 55. They just couldn't get that bottom blood pressure. Like, if they could have got that to 70, I'm sure that would have been. But by the time he stopped putting out urine, and it was one of those things that was just like there's so many things mounting. We both had decided that we were going to stop drinking. So it was a situation where, you know, we both went cold turkey. Well, you know, I don't think either of us felt great because you stop drinking coffee for a day and you get a headache. You know, so I think that we were both dealing with it.
So, so you guys make the decision on Wednesday after the show?
After the show. So, so you know, a week later, he passes. So, obviously, you know, I mean, it was... But the other thing was, and it's really, you know, when you look back at things, it's like, so he wasn't feeling good. So we were kind of, my wife and I were just kind of like waiting on him hand and foot. And we knew, you know, he was trying to do this. And one of the things that if you WebMD that, one of the things of cold turkey is that you have increased rate of having or increased risk of having a seizure. You know, this our society makes alcohol very sexy. You know, James Bond, you know, shaken, not stirred. Women drink, you know, champagne, and everything is so sexy. Drink champagne, and all you do is have the world's, you know, worst headache the next day. It's such a nasty drug. I mean, it's just, and it's a drug. So anybody out there, if you haven't drank, you've probably done yourself an incredible service. If you do drink and you're having problems and you know it's affecting your life and you know it's affecting your health, you can't see the damage it's doing. Especially like nobody goes to the doctor. Nobody gets checked up. Nobody does anything. Nobody gets blood work. And that silent killer, alcohol, is eating your organs, weakening your heart, weakening your constitution. And I have spent half my life glamorizing the rock and roll, hard charging, hard drinking, drug partying, wrestling world that I grew up in and lived in. And I really need to, like, I need to take a step back from that and go, you're part of the problem, Nash. You glamorize a lifestyle that kills people, and you got to stop doing that. You know, this is my cross to bear. You know, it's alcoholism. It took one of my dearest friends, a gentleman named Ben Cianci. It took Scott, and now it's taken my son.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6. Of Eagles Don't Hunt Flies, the show all about the life and career of John Moxley. And I am not Martin Bushby. I am Dickie Bird. But do not worry, I am still joined, as always, by Martin and Brandon from New Jersey. Now, before we get into things, we'll address the elephant in the room. I am on hosting duties today. Don't worry, it's not a permanent thing, but the reason for this, and if you manage to get through the 20-minute cold open to the show, is that back in the middle of 2022, I was working on a project that was going to be kind of like the drive to survive for wrestling. It was a complete unofficial project. I was just going to do it and see if I can put it up there as kind of like free use, as they would be documentaries. And I planned 10 episodes of the stories of 2022. And the first story that I had started working on was John Moxley's return from his battle with alcohol dependency. Now, unfortunately, this project was abandoned later on, mostly due to the fact that later in the year, my wife became pregnant. And I just sort of thought that I really wasn't going to be able to do this whole thing. However, because this was the first episode of that series, and because of the fact that it was a topic that was largely already wrapped up, I had already done a significant amount of work on it. So the 20-minute clip that you actually heard at the start was taken directly from that episode. And we will note that it is of the time in 2022. So there's a couple of unsavory characters that you may have heard in there that we decided as a group to leave in there. Because, of course, the story is not about them anyway. But, yeah, that's kind of the reason why I'm doing this, because, well, I ended up doing a lot of research and know this topic like the back of my hand. And I sort of thought to myself, maybe I should host this one instead of interrupting Martin every 5 minutes with things. So that's it. This is going to be a bit of a heavy episode, as you've probably already gathered from the opener. So in lieu of our normal banter at the start of the shows, I will throw to Martin and Brandon. But what I want to do instead of, hey, how you going? How's your week? How's your month? And all that sort of stuff. What I wanted to do was actually throw to both Martin and Brandon and myself to talk about alcohol in our culture and society, considering that we live on three different continents, and kind of what that actually looks like where we are. So, Brandon, hello, my friend. How are you? But my question to you is in regards to alcohol culture in the US, the first thing that stands out to me, right, is, that's different from where I am and where Martin is that the drinking age is 21. And I guess my question to you is, does that really make any sort of difference over there? And what is the culture of drinking alcohol?
Hey, what's up? Great to talk to you guys again, Richard and I mean Dickie and Martin. Fed out. I don't think it makes a difference. No, I've seen plenty of 18-year-olds and 17-year-olds at like quinceañeras and sweet 16s and party family get-togethers and stuff like that. Still drinking, still imbibing, and still having a good time with alcohol. I remember as a kid, like, my first drink was at, I'm going to say, 12, and it was like a little sip of Budweiser. And I didn't like it at first, but, I mean, it is what it is. But, yeah, it's of no the age doesn't make a difference. People still find a way to drink very, very young.
And like, overall, as a whole, in terms of alcohol culture within the U.S., I mean, knowing what you know about John Moxley and kind of how much he was going, you know, drinking after every wrestling match at the end of the night and all that sort of stuff, is that common over there, would you say? And is it different in different parts of the U.S.?
I guess after a long day at work, you would go to drink the pressure off, drink the tension off, and stuff like that. So I think it's common practice. I mean, the way he drank, I mean, that's pretty abnormal and not good and not healthy. But yeah, it's pretty the norm. And I mean, you see more DUIs and stuff like that, which is even worse and not good. And people, you know, sadly losing their lives because of DUIs and stuff like that and getting into accidents and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's pretty normal practice. Yeah, I don't think it's good, but, I mean, yeah, it's not I guess from my eyes, it's just pretty commonplace.
And, Martin, I guess the UK, the British culture of drinking is probably quite similar to Australia?
Oh, yeah, big time. Obviously, we do have a whole huge drinking culture over in the UK. Yeah, it's fairly common, you know, for everyone to be racing out to the pub or to, you know, going to the supermarket and buying a crate or whatever on a Friday and a Saturday night once you finish work. Yeah, there's a massive drinking culture over here. And it just seems to be sort of like fairly, you know, normalized because that's what people tend to do. I remember being in LA once, actually, where, you know, where Brandon was talking to about sort of like the drinking culture in America. It seemed to be different in when I was in LA because I remember saying to somebody, oh, everyone seems to have a therapist over here. And then they just retorted back to me, oh, well, you guys just drink all your problems away. And that just seems to be this sort of like thing that it is in England. And especially there's a big culture of like binge drinking. And I think that goes back to the time when there'd be our pubs closed at like 11 o'clock and there'd be this, like, you know, there'd be a bell at 10:30 saying like, oh, last order. So you'd immediately run to the bar and get like 3 more pints. So you had enough to drink till like midnight. But since they've moved more into 24-hour licensing and pubs and bars are open longer, I still think the culture is that you've got to drink as much as you can while you're in the bar sort of thing. So yeah, there's a big culture of sort of like binge drinking on a weekend, big time.
Yeah, so in Australia, I sort of found that we've got things in place to try and restrict drinking. I don't think they work. Kind of like what Brandon said about the drinking age being 21. Like, what is that? Why is it like that? Is it to stop people drinking at a younger age? Does it work? Doesn't seem to. But we have things here in place that are not similar to New Zealand, which is the other country that I lived in as an adult. There's no lockouts in New Zealand or anything like that. But also there's other strange things, like if you went to a bottle shop, the biggest amount of beer that you can buy is a dozen, 12 beers in a pack. When I moved over here, that doesn't exist. It's not that you can buy more, because you can. The high sort of like a standard case, I guess, is 24, but there is no in between. You either get a 6-pack or a 24-pack. And it sort of, to me, paints a bit of a picture about what it is like here in Australia. The culture of drinking here is, in my opinion, out of control. Not necessarily saying that you hear too many people doing stupid things, but I think it's more that it's just so normalized. It's so okay. Having a beer at start, so I shouldn't even say having a beer, starting drinking at lunch is not unusual. We have something here called Sunday sesh, which basically just means because it's maybe summertime, the sun is out, Sunday, you've got work on Monday, right? So don't drink later in the day because then it'll be harder to go to work the next day. So everyone goes to the pub at lunchtime and not just has a drink or two, but you get, you know, you binge drink and then maybe stop at around, you know, 7 or 8 p.m. to try and sober up to the next day. That's common. That's people in Australia. Maybe I made it sound a little bit more dramatic, but people in Australia wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't say that's too out of the ordinary.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same in England. Like we have, and I feel like a bit hypocritical because I partake in these things at weekends, but maybe not every weekend going out at lunch and then coming home at 7 o'clock. But obviously we have bottomless brunches where you go and, you know, you can have as much Prosecco or beer as you want and things like that. And I feel like they're putting more in place in terms of like being stricter with ID and things like that now. Cause when I was younger, like if you knew the certain shops or pubs to go in, you could get served when you were like 15, 16 and things like that. So yeah, it's certainly a lot stricter than when I first started going out and things when I was a teenager.
Well, we got out here, we got a lot of day drinking too, especially during the weekends and the summer months. Like, it's crazy, especially on the boardwalk down the shore. My goodness, it's like especially in Wildwood. it's pretty crazy. Pretty wild times during the summer for day drinkers.
But look at the we've a week removed from Elimination Chamber. What was the first thing they did on that press conference? Let's have a shoey.
Yeah,
you know, let's pour a beer into our shoe and down it. You know, I mean, that was we're in Australia now, and this is what they do over here.
I was going to bring that up, and you're right. Like, I can't. Let's just say we go to WrestleMania, right, Brandon? I can't see at what do they call it, the world now, or whatever WrestleMania access or something, that you've got two wrestlers doing a drinking competition or something. It's unheard of from a normal WWE perspective. They might be part of storylines and all that sort of stuff, but in terms of, media or publication, fan event, press conference, whatever, it's not very common within the normal WWE sphere. Come to Australia, shoeys, you got Tai Tuivasa and Grayson Waller in the front row doing shoeys and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I found that fascinating when I saw that, because that is, again, it's so part of our culture, not just living here, but outside of Australia. That's what people really think of us. And they're not wrong. It's not great here. I live in a very, very small town. If I wanted to buy a physical video game, I would have to drive 30 minutes to a much bigger town. But they have five pubs in the town, kind of thing. Mm. Like, it's interesting what the demand is here for alcohol. But, I guess I just wanted to maybe set the tone a little bit, sort of start talking about it, and really kind of start kicking into this episode, because there's going to be a lot that maybe we get into from a personal perspective a little bit later on. But I just thought, hey, let's talk about John Moxley's final match before he checks himself into rehab. Alcohol inpatient facility, I believe, is like the correct name. Just so everyone knows, I'm going to refer to it as rehab just because John Moxley himself calls it that. So I feel like it's okay, even though, the Tony Khan uses a very specific term. but yeah, so on the 27th of October, 2021, John Moxley faces off against Preston Vance, also known as Ten, now known as Brandon Perry Pellegrino. What's his name?
Perry Pellegrosso.
I stopped following, these people's name changes and stuff. I just call them Ten anyway, still. So this was part of the Full Gear 2021 Title Eliminator Tournament. You guys might be able to tell me, this was the pay-per-view where Hangman Page defeated Kenny Omega. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay. I guess it was Mox on one side, along with a lot of other jobbers, and Bryan Danielson was on the other side of the bracket with a lot of other jobbers. So you could really see where this was going in terms of the final matchup in the Eliminator tournament that was going to be happening at Full Gear. So John Moxley comes out. Now, before we even talk about what happens in this match. And it's funny because it's something that a lot of people talked about when he returned, which was how different he looked when he returned. We have a different perspective now because when he returned, he obviously lost a lot of muscle definition. He obviously lost a lot of his normal wrestling kind of presence and physique.
He looked real bloated too in this match.
That's what I was going to say is at the moment in 2024, this is the real John Moxley. This is the peak John Moxley. This isn't bloated John Moxley. This isn't coming back, haven't wrestled in 3 months John Moxley. The 2024 version is what we see now. Now we can take this 2024 version and cross-reference it to this 2021 version just beforehand. And I was going to throw to you, Brandon, because tell me what you see when you see this man come out.
He looked like a bloated grizzly bear. Like, I was like, wow, he looks so different than like what he is now. Like, he's in incredible shape now. He's taking care of his well-being and whatnot, but man, he didn't look good at all.
Yeah, for me the one thing that I noticed most importantly is his head. And you know, I don't mean to, you know, we're not trying to shame anybody or anything, but it's more of a very physical thing that happens when you consume a lot of alcohol over a certain period of time, is that it actually bloats your face. That's just the reality of what it does. And yeah, you see these two things right next to each other in a lot of these comparisons. You're just like, wow, this is an advertisement for what alcohol can do to you if you consume it irresponsibly and a lot.
Also, I don't know what the medical term for it is, but it obviously starts making your face quite red as well. Obviously, British listeners to this will know football managers from the 80s and 90s, you know, obviously that was like have a bottle of wine after a game and things like that. And they started, you know, a lot of football managers from the 80s and 90s have got like really red faces, like Brian Clough, yeah, Harry Redknapp, you know, Alex Ferguson to a certain respect.
Fergie's cheeks, man. Oh my God. They were redder than Santa's alpha in Christmas time.
Hey man,
there must be a medical sort of like reason. Obviously, something's happening to your face.
Yeah, yeah, and just on that too. I mean, we heard Kevin Nash at the top of the show saying he glamorized alcohol in wrestling. Man, I remember watching WCW, and that guy always had like red nose, red face when he'd come out for promos and stuff. And looking back, when I watched it back now, I can see. I'm like, wow, you're drunk right now, aren't you, Nash?
Mm.
We'll kick on with the match. Moxley storms to the ring through the crowd, goes to open the barricade, but a fan is standing in the way, so he aggressively pushes the fan out of the way. Clearly, this was not a plant because the fan had a giant grin on his face the whole time, and security rushed to get him out of the way. Moxley was pissed here. Sorry, and I will rephrase that so that our British friends don't think I'm referring to something else. He was very angry as part of his character, but you would shoot get hurt if you stood in the way. So, look, this is a very, very quick match. Moxley gets in the ring. Immediately German suplexes 10 before stumping a mud hole in him. Tim gets some offense in before getting cut off. 10 is sent face first in the stairs on the outside. Then Moxley starts ripping 10's mask off and biting his forehead. Moxley throws 10 into the ring post before flipping him the double bird. 10 comes up bleeding from the forehead, gets a little bit of offense in. Moxley shrugs it off, gives 10 a King Kong lariat from hell, I wrote, which was just ridiculous. And then giving him the paradigm shift for the 1-2-3 in 2 minutes and 4 seconds. Moxley storms out, kicks the barricade right into another fan, a different one, standing in the same spot as the previous fan. And they should really make sure that nobody actually ever stands there at all anyway. Martin, what do you remember about Moxley at this time? Because he clearly was showing a little bit of a different side. And what did you think about this match overall?
Well, I mean, if you want to see somebody who literally wants to get the fuck out of there, then watch this match. Because it's like you said, he literally goes in there. They have a bit of a mess around. He hits him with that lariat from hell, and then it's the 1-2-3. And this poor guy's just obviously gigged himself to get some colour for this match, and it's like it didn't even matter. You've never seen somebody like Moxley just storm to the ring, and obviously that's part of the character anyway, and obviously, you know, the fan getting in the way, you know, that can be put down to him, you know, being hyped up and everything like that, but he just literally looks like a guy who wants to get in there and get the fuck out of there.
When I watched this match back, I was like, man, this was the time, too, when AEW security wasn't really the greatest security ever, when the fans start jumping into the ring and stuff like that and other stuff. But I was like, man, he beat the fuck out of this dude. It was like he stole something from him. And he, like what Martin said, he wanted to be anywhere else but in the ring. He wanted to get the fuck out of there. And he did so at post-haste.
So during this time, I mean, I remember when I watched this match vividly at the time, I thought, man, what the hell's going on? Because even though Moxley was starting to turn into this character, he was going through a character change, according to a lot of people. We obviously didn't even see it, you know, fully realized, because this was his last TV match. I went back and I thought, I'll go watch the match he had on Dynamite before this one. So his previous AEW match. And I went on Cage Match to find out what it was. And I was like, oh, it's the match against Wheeler Yuta. And then I looked at the time of the match and I was like, oh, it's not that match against Wheeler Yuta. It's not the, 9 out of 10 rated match that he had with Wheeler Yuta, which happened after he came back from rehab. It was a 47-second match where he came out and did what he did to 10, but even quicker, and just bet his ass. He didn't, though, bite his forehead and make him bleed. And that was, I think, what I remember about this particular match against 10. Because, I mean, John Moxley, he's like Steve Austin. You know, if he comes out and kicks someone's ass in 47 seconds, it's like, cool, man, that's what he does. But if you think back to Steve Austin, like in the Attitude area, if he came out and then started biting someone's face, even though we've seen him do it before against like Juice Robinson in New Japan, you know, it's super unusual, but there was something different about this particular match. He very much felt like, I remember watching this match and thinking something's wrong. Now, again, I'm not saying that there was anything that, you know, that this was different than what was planned, say, for instance. But, yeah, I felt really uneasy when I watched this for the first time.
Well, that's really interesting, yeah, because I couldn't remember this match, to be honest with you, until you brought it back up again for this. And, yeah, just watching it, knowing what you know now, and especially all the stuff that we'll be talking about later, the stuff he's talking about on Renee's podcast, it certainly gives a lot more sort of like clarity to, you know, what mindset he was in during when he was having this match.
So I apologize for saying before that this was his last match before entering rehab, because it wasn't his last match before entering rehab. It was his last AEW televised match, or his last televised match in total. But he would go on the 30th of October 2021 to wrestle Jimmy Jacobs at Wrestling Revolver. Of course, his close friend Sammy Callahan runs Wrestling Revolver, and we'll hear him talk a little bit about that later. And then on the night of Halloween, 31st of October 2021, John Moxley would check himself into rehab. It's worth noting that John Moxley's autobiography entitled Mox was released on November the 2nd. And, of course, there's nothing specifically in the book about his struggles with alcohol. There's a lot in the book about him consuming alcohol. In fact, on the first page, he even refers to himself as a borderline alcoholic. But of course, it is written in a way that you kind of, I think a lot of people, myself maybe, would say I'm a borderline alcoholic kind of thing. You know, no one read it and sort of, well, I shouldn't say no one read it and thought, because of course, by the time people read it, he was in rehab. But I think when he wrote that, he didn't expect people to read that and think, oh God, you know, whatever. I think he just assumed people would be like, ha ha, that's Mox sort of thing. So that was, that book was released on November 2nd, and later that evening, Tony Khan posts the following series of tweets. John Moxley has allowed me to share with you that he is entering inpatient alcohol treatment program. John is a beloved member of the AEW family. We will stand with him and Renee and all of his family and friends as he shifts his focus to recovery. John is making a very brave choice to get help, and we're embracing his choice and supporting him however we can. I'm proud to call John a friend, and like many of you, I'm also a fan of Mox and look forward to a time in the future where he's eventually ready to return to the ring. Until then, thank you for supporting John and respecting his privacy at this time. Brandon, do you know where you were when this news dropped?
Did you real or fake where I was at? I think I was probably watching, what day was this on? Because it might have been, I might have been in the Discord watching
Dynamite. We were, in fact, in the Discord watching NXT.
Oh, we're watching NXT. Okay. Fair enough. We're watching something. But, yeah, mm-hmm. I was shocked when I saw this. I mean, I was like, wow, like, what's AEW going to do without their ace? Like, he's the dude. Like, they're in the middle of a pretty good storyline with, John Moxley. And, I guess he was turning heel or whatever and going through like a mini Austin type of, beating the shit out of people type of, program and whatnot. But yeah, it was pretty shocking that I mean, this guy who I've never heard any negatives like drug issues or something like that, but he seemed to live a clean life outside of hardcore matches and stuff like that, and whatnot, and his love of grappling and stuff like that. It was very shocking when I saw this series of tweets by TK.
And man, I imagine you were asleep.
I think we were all shocked, weren't we? Yeah, probably was asleep. I think we were all shocked, weren't we, when we heard this news. And like Dave Meltzer said at the start of the show, it was kind of just that's what the thing you did. You know, you go out and have a match and then have a couple of sort of like JDs and Cokes after the match. And you kind of just assumed sort of like he had it under control. And that was just sort of like, you know, he's just a hard drinking dude. But, you know, he was, you know, sort of had it under control, because you've got to remember, even in the indies, I mean, one of Mox's most famous matches on the indies is the one he has against Neil Diamond Cutter in IWA Mid-South, and that's famous for, they had a shot of whiskey every sort of like 5 minutes of the match. Mox comes out singing Sweet Caroline. And even looking back at that now, because I was talking to a lot of people about what matches to cover when we're doing this podcast series, and it's kind of like, everyone was like, oh, well, you've got to talk about that one. It's like, yeah, but it seems a bit wrong now. You know, that's who he was before, and this is who he is now, sort of thing. So, yeah, it's it just seemed like that was the whole part of his character. But obviously, it was great that he did sort of like realize he'd got to the breaking point and reached out and, you know, got the help that he needed.
Yeah, I remember when this came out, and like I said, I was watching NXT 2.0 with Brandon at the time, and I felt really uneasy. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say I was upset or emotional or whatever, but there's just something that, you know, he's such a reliable kind of guy, as a, and I mean that as a fan, you know, he's there every week. He was the Iron Man in WWE. You know, injuries are one thing, and people get injured, and you're kind of used to that. But yeah, there was just something about this that when it happened, it kind of felt like, you know, one of your parents when you're a kid who you think is invincible, they're like a superhero, and then something happens to them, and then you sort of feel like the whole world sort of is kind of falling apart, that perspective that you have of them. So yeah, I just remember not feeling like just not really knowing how to feel, to be honest. You should feel like, oh, you know, we will, you know, fuck yeah, go for it, Mox, you know, we got you. You know, there was all this outpouring of support by wrestlers like Sting and Dustin Rhodes, who obviously had their own struggles in the past that are well documented. And that's how I thought I would have felt. But it was, yeah, I don't know. I just felt this kind of weird way, this sadness about the whole thing. And, you know, we heard off the top, you mentioned Dave Meltzer, but, you know, even Wei Ting as well, saying, you know, it is surprising because of how active that he's been. You know, you would have expected somebody who's struggling with this to maybe, you know, not want to go or not go to wrestling events and stuff like that. But yeah, so it's sort of, yeah, it came as a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, totally, because how many, you know, obviously this is wrestling and, you know, people are sadly in and out of rehab and various facilities and things like that. And, you know, DDP always says, you know, it's, you know, people can fall off the wagon numerous times. It's all about getting, you know, getting back on the wagon and things like that. So, yeah, it's just something that seems to be commonplace in wrestling, doesn't it?
So the next day, the morning of the next AEW Dynamite, it was a Wednesday morning, Renee tweets out, "Thanks for this outpouring of support. John is every bit of the badass we all know him to be. I couldn't be more proud of him for getting the proper help he needs and being given the space to put his health first. Couldn't possibly love this man more." And again, I remember reading this and just thinking, oh man, just it must, like, what must be going on right now? Like, I'm pleased that she tweeted something, because I think a lot of people, you know, it was best wishes to John and Renee and their child in this situation. So it's glad that she released something so soon afterwards. But yeah, just it's starting to become quite heavy. In that sense. Now, that later that night in Dynamite, and it was the first thing that we heard at the cold open of the show, was CM Punk. And of course, CM Punk is straight edge. So he kind of, you know, we all know about this in terms of, you know, how alcohol affected his, I guess, like his father and stuff and that growing up. And so he's obviously very supportive. I'm not going to rehash the promo because we heard it, but he did speak to Bleacher Report, and he said that when the Moxley news first broke, first and foremost, we needed to make sure that he was in a good spot and that he knew he didn't have to rush back and that he can work on himself and his family. But I didn't know exactly what to say or how to approach it. I just knew that I would figure it out once I got in front of the people. You saw signs in the crowd already from people supporting Moxley. We came to a point where we had a very powerful message to send, a message of courage on his part and a message of support on our part. And I think the real world needs to see that right now. We're all real we're all real people with real problems. Now, Martin, it's interesting because, of course, the last two episodes that we've done of the series is John Moxley versus CM Punk. So it was probably a bit jarring for everybody listening to this that the first thing that they hear on this episode is CM Punk saying some very nice things about John Moxley. But one of the things that he did say is that he's not seen eye to eye with John Moxley in the past. Now, this is before his feud that we covered, at least the AEW feud. Did you find that kind of interesting to hear him say that and kind of think to ourselves, especially after us doing these episodes, what does he mean by that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think I even brought it up in those episodes that he'd said that in the promo. But obviously, even if there was some disagreement between them or they didn't quite see eye to eye or they'd never hang out and be friends, that was all irrelevant at that moment in time because Punk obviously understood where Mox was coming from, and he talked, didn't he, about the sort of like, you know, you've just got to go and trying to be, you know, you're the best you can be and the best wrestler you can be, but sometimes you've just got to stop and get the help that you need.
Brandon, do you remember this promo by CM Punk? And, you know, he kind of mixed it in with his feud with Eddie Kingston, where he was kind of calling Eddie Kingston a loser for not turning up for work, but at the same time trying to, you know, say, hey, there's someone else not showing up for work that we need to support. Do you remember this?
Yes.
What do you think of this promo?
It was a very good promo. I mean, CM Punk's like one of the best promos around, but it was like so weird that it was so weird at first the way he cuts down on Kingston and then he gives his well wishes to Moxley. It was like mixing fantasy with reality. It's like a real kick in the stomach, like you know, there's real shit going on with you know, a teammate of yours or a coworker. Like, you know, he's trying to fix his life and he's going through some things. It was a very unique blend of fantasy and reality, the way Punk did it for that promo. It was very good.
I will give them credit because it had to be the very first thing that they address.
Address the elephant in the room, and they're good at that. I'll give them credit for that.
I think at this time they were very good at it. I mean,
I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, after Punk went all mental and stuff, I don't know how good they were at kind of getting the elephant out of the room. But I mean, you know, it was sort of like you couldn't not address this. Now, did CM Punk need to be the one that addressed it? Could you have someone else come out, you know, do kind of like a cold open like we've done at the start of this show? But I think, you know, CM Punk, locker room leader, whether or not you like it or not, probably made a lot of sense. He probably wanted to be the one who said something. And I think, you know, relating to his time leaving WWE or, you know, needing to take care of himself, obviously that's how he related the promo to what John Mox is going to. I thought that was a good idea because, again, you know, what we'll, you know, touch on, especially in John Moxley's promo returning, you know, this isn't necessarily about alcohol. You know, this is about suffering and recovery in whatever it may be. So I thought he was a good person to kind of sew those two things together. So
well, fans needed it as well, didn't they? Irrelevant of whether you were a fan of Moxley or not, or worried about him or not, you know, the fans definitely needed that, just that. Because you've been so used to WWE sort of like trying to shove that stuff to the side and sweep it under the carpet. And I think the fans needed, you know, that promo from Punk just to, you know, so they could be like, yeah, you know, Moxley's going to sort of like beat this thing.
100%. And it would be very strange if they ignored it, sort of thing. So, look, 100%, lots of credit to Tony Khan and AEW for not trying to sweep this under the rug, because, again, it all should it lead to positive changes at the end of the day. So after Dynamite went off the air, Tony Khan addressed the audience. This is a clip that you can find on YouTube. It obviously didn't air. But Khan says that it's been the second hardest week of his life since being in the wrestling business. The first I guess the first thing that he's referencing would be the death of Brody Lee. That's what he says. Brian Danielson takes the mic, and, you know, everyone is not in character at this point. So Brian Danielson takes the mic, talks about the last text message he sent to Brody Lee, and then gives credit to John Moxley for helping bring Danielson to AEW. Danielson says he's not sure he can keep up, and Moxley said, "You're Brian fucking Danielson, you're best in the world." At this point, Brian Danielson is looking very emotional, just recounting these things, because, of course, one of the things that everyone needs to realize is that, you know, John Moxley, he went into rehab and then everybody found out about it and there's no way to contact him. You know, obviously everyone can pass on messages to Renee and everything, but, you know, it's almost like, you know, that person's not gone forever, but they are temporarily gone. They're not contactable or anything like that. Mm. Moxley continues saying to Brian Danielson, "I'm not telling you you should come here, but don't for a goddamn second think that you can't." And then Brian Danielson proceeded to bring Justin Robertson to the ring and take his tie off and try and choke him with it so that everyone can have a bit of a laugh. And I wrote here, Tony Khan is a bit of a goof, but he did a very, very good thing. He was responsible during this week, and so I think he needs a lot of credit for that.
This is when TK is he starting to get on those focus medications, and he's not blinking during his promos whenever he's talking to the audience now? Is this the era of
I'm just trying to think how much he was really around at this point in terms of being on camera and stuff. Like, I mean, he was really only doing the in between Rampage and Dynamite would come out, you know, and people would film that, you know, the Greek freak. I'm not going to try to butcher his name, you know.
Giannis Akutakuma!
You know, but that never aired or anything like that, you know. So, but yeah, he's definitely has a bit more on-screen presence at the moment. So just to wrap this part up quickly so that everybody's kind of up to speed with sort of what ended up happening to this title tournament and what was supposed to happen. So Moxley, after he beat 10, was scheduled to face Orange Cassidy at the next Dynamite, and then he would go on to face Brian Danielson at the Full Gear pay-per-view in 2021. However, Moxley was replaced by Miro, who beat Cassidy and then lost to Danielson at the pay-per-view. And that is the end of this chapter, in the sense that John Moxley is now in rehab. We as fans don't know what's going to happen. Life goes on, wrestling goes on, Dynamite goes on. And we just hope that we see or hear some news at some time in the future. Martin, you know, just because this is all sort of, you know, realistically, this is the last time that we kind of see or really hear from or hear about John Moxley as fans until January, this being the end of October. I mean, how did you feel? Do you remember AEW at this time? Missing John Moxley, was it really a big deal? Did they step up in other areas, etc.?
I think for me, obviously, it was a big deal being a big fan of Moxley, and you just kind of hope that you just assumed that he was just, you know, having his time in this wellness facility, rehab, whatever you want to call it, and you know, you'd assume he was going to come back when he was ready and willing. I honestly, the time around Dynamite, I honestly can't remember what was going on. I just remember the fact that Moxley wasn't there, and I was just assuming that he was going to come back when he was ready to come back, because how many times have we had sort of wrestlers rush out of rehab and come back when they're not ready? So, yeah, he was just hoping that he was going to spend the time and take his time and come back when he was 100% ready.
Did you think for a second that maybe he would never come back?
No, I always thought he would come back because obviously, you know, it's the cliche, but wrestlers have got it in the blood, haven't they? And especially him, 100%. He's someone who sort of like lives and breathes wrestling. I think, you know, he would be determined to kick whatever was affecting his wrestling career. That would have been the first thing that he would have been wanting to do. So, yeah, it was never in my mind that he wasn't coming back.
I agree, and I loved hearing during his interview with Renee, you know, the doctors and therapists were like, you've got to stop wrestling, you know, open a school or something like this is, you know, whatever. And he's just, and his casual response is like, nah, I don't think that's it. You know, like, that's not really the reason why this is happening. You know, just kind of like, it never crossed his mind. Yeah, we'll get to that. So like I said, John Moxley is in rehab as we speak. I mean, in terms of the timeline of events here.
Yeah.
But we are going to kind of do a bit of messing with the timeline to kind of reference what he's experiencing right now. And so we're going to play a clip from the sessions with Renee Paquette where he sat down with her on the 24th of June 2022, so months after he actually returned to discuss it. And I have a clip here that I'll play about him entering rehab.
Like I said, it all happened in like 15 minutes. Like it was fast. It was like I could feel the world closing in on me. And I think I knew subconsciously that it was like it was coming. I know I had this one indie show for Sammy for Wrestling Revolver. That was the last show I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, also, I think in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I just got to get through this pay-per-view. Then I'll be clear. But I just got to get through this pay-per-view. So it's probably how I was thinking. Maybe. But whatever I was thinking. Got through that last indie show for Sammy because I was like, I can't bail on this. You know, they're counting on me. And I think I was just like, I could feel like the world closing in on me. Cause like people were texting me, like Eddie texted me like, you all right or something. And I'm like, yeah, why? And I'm like, so I knew you were like talking to people.
Shout out to Eddie, by the way. Eddie was honestly so like, was one like, of those people I that I checked. Like, he checked in on me a lot. I was starting
to feel like people were noticing whether they were or not. I knew you were. So I was like,
no, I was on you. Like,
I felt like the world was like closing in on me. Like and then I was in Des Moines, got on a Southwest flight. They don't serve booze on Southwest flights for some reason.
Well, that was anymore. During like pandemic times. Yeah. Right.
So I knew that. So I was like, well, I'm getting loaded before I get on this plane, 3-hour flight. So I was like loaded when I landed, came home. And like somewhere in there, I feel like you were already like mad at me or I don't even know. Like I could just feel the entire world closing in on me. And I was just like, I cannot go another day like this. I can't go one more day. Mm-hmm. Like it's over. And I was just like, it happened in like minutes. Yeah. I was just like, I'm going to rehab. And you're like, okay, I call the place. I was like, it was Halloween night. I was like, I didn't tell anybody else or anything. And I was standing outside and like, I'm on the phone with them.
That was so
like giving them my information or like my credit card information or something. And like, kids are walking up to me while I'm on the phone with rehab and they're like, trick or treat. I'm like, give me 1 second. I'm gonna pop a Snickers bar in here. Yeah. Yeah. And they're like, one kid here. I'm like, right now. They're like, cool. Called an Uber. It was maybe 10, 15 minutes away from the house. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
An hour after I walked into the door, I was just like walking into rehab. It just was like,
yeah,
it was over. And I was probably in some kind of a stupor, you know, for a minute. But what I was getting to with when people finding out, I don't know what kind of state of mind I was in for the first. I felt really defeated for like the first day, just like really defeated. But then I got on a little payphone thing with you, and you were like, I was like, what's the deal? And I think you said, yeah, I talked to Tony and like Mega and everything's cool. They just want to know how you want to broach the subject, because like I was advertised for a match. So they're like, do you want to tell people? Or
and it's not like you were going to be off for like a weekend. You were going to be off obviously for like,
yeah, or do you want to just say like it was up to me? It was like we can and I was like, I guess I'm not gonna lie, but they can also just say a personal reason. But I don't lie. And but I was like, I guess just tell the fucking truth, right? And you're like, I guess. And I went, here's exactly what I said to you. I said, tell him to say whatever the fuck he wants. And you're like, okay. No, can't have been it. You know, I was like, tell him to say whatever the fuck he wants. I don't care. And you're like, cool. And then like the next day I talked to you on the little phone and they're like, yeah, they just like, everybody knows. And I was like, huh.
Yeah, there's okay. Like some freedom with that almost, right?
Really? Huh. Everybody knows I'm in rehab now? And like, I don't have a phone, so like, I'm not like, I don't know what the reaction is or anything, but I knew it was out there. And then like, I think I went into like some class or group or speech or something next. Like I went into some room with people and I remember just bopping in there, like feeling really good. Like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I just went, oh, everybody knows.
Yeah.
Cause this thing is this thing I've been hiding and trying to hide from people for so long. Mm-hmm. The ones that is like, oh, everybody knows. And I don't care.
I remember like, feeling the same way too.
Yeah, it was just a very much like, them. I don't care. They can call me whatever they want and call me whatever names they want. I don't give a shit. I'm doing what I got to do for myself. Like, them.
It was sure.
A huge weight lifted off.
But like, also like on the other side of that, like it was a big relief for me too, for people to know that, because I had to put a lot of stuff on hold too. Like I had to put the show on hold for a minute. I was like, there's no way I can go on and be like, hey, welcome to the show, come hang out, and like act like everything was fine. So like this show had to be put on hold. We were moving, we were doing all these things, but also like it just felt like so many people were so like kind about it, the people that reached out and wanted to talk about it. And also like how common it is, how many people have been through something like this, and whether it's, you know, public information or not, people kind of crawl out of the woodwork being like, hey, been there, been down that road. So it was actually really nice for me to feel like I didn't have to hide anything anymore. Like the last thing I wanted to do was like, I felt like I was like protecting you in a way during all that too. Where like, I didn't want anyone to ever think that anything was up, but then to be able to like actually talk to people about it. And like, I mean, everybody, it really was like a big relief to me. It made me feel like a lot less alone.
So that is from the episode of the sessions, which I would encourage everybody to go and watch in full. The full thing is about an hour long. we just talked about, you know, feeling uneasy and you know, not knowing what's going on, sort of thing. Brandon, now that you know that in the background, John Moxley was just like, oh fuck, everyone knows, fuck it. Let's fucking go. Does it change a little bit sort of thinking back to this time period of kind of, you know, a bit of sadness and sort of like hearing he has a bit of levity on the situation?
Yeah, they're the canter between them two, like, I mean, the vibes were immaculate between them two and the situation at hand, especially how they dealt with it. It's refreshing to hear like the blunt honesty, like with the situation, and like they were chill about it, and like they were like, you know, people, I guess the feeling is like, you know, he's not dead, he's alive, he's getting his shit together, and everything's gonna be all right, everything's copacetic, and like we shouldn't be in this. We should feel bad, and we want him to get well, but also, you know, it's going to be okay. Like they seem very at ease. Like it was very refreshing to hear that type of honesty about the situation.
And Martin, I mean, the other thing that really stands out on this clip is the right decision was to be open and honest about this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no point in sort of like hiding it, especially, you know, what were they going to explain where he'd gone and things like that. Yeah, definitely. They were completely 100% right in being honest about it. And it was really eye-opening for me, especially that is an absolutely brilliant episode of that podcast. And like you said, I highly recommend everyone goes and listens to it. But yeah, really eye-opening for me in terms of like, you know, what your body goes through when you're trying to come off beer and alcohol and what have you, because I, you know, obviously I understood it was really hard and, you know, alcoholism is a disease, but I didn't know the sort of like kind of effects that it has on your physically how it has on you. I know we're going to touch on a lot more of that later, but listening to that was real eye-opener for me.
So that kind of, you know, you segues into this topic, which, again, you know, it's probably referenced in a little bit, but may as well go over it here. You said you didn't really realize, Brandon, were you aware that if your body becomes dependent on alcohol, that you can die if you just stop drinking?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, Dred Roberts, a big time alcoholic. Look at him.
What happened with him?
He died.
Thanks, Brandon.
You're welcome. I mean, I know some people that have dealt with alcoholism. I've known some people who in my personal life who died of alcoholism because of liver damage and stuff like that. Like, you could smell them, like the alcohol in their body, like it's just seeping out of their pores. It's not a good deal. Like, what's that rock and roll documentary? I forget. There was this dude by the pool. He's just like drinking like an obscene amount of vodka, and while his mom is just sitting there watching him decompose. But it's a sickness like no other. It's ridiculous.
So 100%. I don't think any of us didn't realize the terrible effects that drinking heavily long term can have on your body, you know, health issues down the line, diabetes, adult onset diabetes, like you said, liver damage, liver disease. But, you know, Kevin Nash's son was 26 years of age. You know, he wasn't suffering from long term drinking. He just drank a lot to the point where his body was dependent on it and basically had a seizure, which caused a cardiac arrest, and then he died. Now, that's something that, you know, was news to me. Now, again, you know, I feel like a lot of people might come out at me and say, like, how did you not know? You know, how did you not know that would happen? Well, it's because it's not really something that gets taught a lot or hammered into your brain when it comes to alcohol. You know, the top ones are don't drink and drive or operate heavy machinery. Don't drink when you're pregnant, you know, because it can damage your baby. And I guess because the drinking age is 18 or 21, depending on where you live, you know, don't drink when you're younger because it can hurt your development. And then, of course, other things like we mentioned before, liver disease and stuff like that, long-term things that you kind of hear like older people sort of have. But I really don't feel like there is enough awareness around to tell people that if you get up in the morning at 9 o'clock and you don't have a coffee, but you have a beer and you just keep drinking beer up until the point in which you go to sleep and then you wake up and you do the same, and you do that for, I don't know, a week. No one's really sure. But if you do that every day for a week and then you stop, that there's a good probability that you'll at least have a seizure and possibly even die. And yeah, I just until I started working on this episode for this documentary that I was doing, like, it just never really it's not talked about enough. I think I saw maybe an episode of House with Hugh Laurie, which something to do with it, but it's just not in, it's not in the sphere of alcohol problems. And I feel like it needs a bit more attention. And I applaud this episode for really highlighting these things. Martin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was the same as you. Obviously, you know, you get educated on a lot of stuff, you know, that isn't directly affecting you. And obviously, like I said before, I knew it was a serious issue and I knew it was hard to get off it, but I didn't realize it affected you physically like that. And this was really eye-opening to me. And perhaps there is other things out there that I've been saying this for years, but not that I've seen or read. And so, like, these and all this stuff, especially around this episode, and then listening to Renee's podcast with Mox back then, I was like, wow, it was really eye-opening to me, and I had no idea that there was all this stuff then. So, you know, hats off to them for educating people on, you know, that it isn't just a case of like, oh, well, you've just got to, you know, quit cold turkey or wean yourself off alcohol because, you know, it can have devastating effects on you.
And I guess sorry, Brandon, you go.
I'm sorry. Before I forget, the documentary is called Decline of Western Civilization 2, and that's really good.
Okay. I'll make sure to check it out. I suppose the one other thing that's really interesting about all of this is that you don't really hear John Moxley refer to himself as an alcoholic or a recovering alcoholic. And like I said, he mentioned he was a borderline alcoholic in the book that he wrote before he checked himself into rehab. But really the feeling that I get, and I have a friend who, you know, I'll remain nameless. He does listen to the show, but he's sort of in a similar boat where he doesn't consider himself an alcoholic, and he doesn't want anybody to call him that. Because it's not that he just recognizes that he had to stop and he just doesn't drink anymore. And, you know, I've always found that very interesting because John Moxley's kind of the same as well. He doesn't go to AA. He doesn't talk about his feelings. It really wasn't even because he did anything wrong or whatever. He just drank to the point where his body became reliant on it. And he doesn't necessarily think that's not how he or even I associate what alcoholics are. An alcoholic is somebody who's kind of screwed their life up and can't hold down a job because they're always drunk or whatever. It doesn't really describe a high functioning person who really sees no problem with what they're doing. And no one else really sees a problem with what they're doing until maybe, you know, closer to the end or, you know, them needing to go to rehab. But it's really just a real physical medical issue that your body becomes addicted. And unlike things like nicotine, say, for instance, if you stop cold turkey, like it will actually do serious damage. So I thought a lot of that stuff was interesting. Like we said, do listen to the full episode. It's on Spotify and Apple Music, but there's also a video version on YouTube as well. Just type in the sessions, Moxley. So,
yeah, it's like one of those things, though, isn't it? Because when I was younger, I just assumed an alcoholic was someone who woke up in the morning and downed half a bottle of vodka, you know, but there's levels to these things, isn't you? And you're talking about people who function well with these things. I remember watching a documentary years ago, and it was about the effects of heroin, and you assume that most people on heroin are using it all the time and it ruins their lives and, you know, they're stealing off everyone they know and you know, blah blah blah, all the stuff you see in sort of movies. But in that, they had people who would take it on the weekend, go and work for the rest of the week, and then just have another hit on the weekend. And so there is just levels to this stuff, and it's not, well, you know, one sort of size fits all.
For sure, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So Brandon had said that the vibes on the podcast were immaculate, and it was, for people who don't know, the two of them in their home, comfortable setting, just chilling, talking with one another. I wanted to reference this ESPN article written by Mark Raimondi, who is a journalist I really like. So it was really cool to see the two worlds collide here. Mark Raimondi usually more focuses on MMA, UFC stuff. I know Bran very familiar with him.
Oh, yeah.
An article was published on ESPN around about the same time that this episode of The Sessions came out. And it goes over a lot of the same stuff, but it paints a little bit of a darker picture to the whole thing. So I wanted to have a bit of a read of it. This is in place of the book corner with Dickie Bird. So this is from the article. It was affecting his life. When he was younger, he said he could drink a 750 milliliter bottle of Jack Daniels at night, get up in the morning to run 5 miles, and then work a 25-minute main event match in the evening. Before going into rehab, though, a routine waking up feeling terrible, chugging water, hitting the sauna, and downing countless aspirin to feel somewhat normal became common. Moxley said that when he arrived for matches or segments at AEW, he had to shake the brain fog caused by his hangovers and mentally prepare himself to get ready to perform in character. The people closest to him began to notice too. Eddie Kingston said that he breached the topic with Moxley on a few occasions. Renee Paquette said that she started really seeing it when she was pregnant with Nora. She could no longer drink, but Moxley kept going. Over the years, she said he would watch the clock for 5 p.m. That time began getting earlier and earlier. Seeing him drinking the way that he was and the amount that he was putting back, it was a lot, Paquette says. It's hard to watch your partner going through something like that and trying to point out to them like, hey, it doesn't have to be like that. You don't have to drink like that. Over time, he started not even wanting to go wrestle. For someone who has dedicated his life to the art, who will have physical bloody matches on shows of all sizes worldwide, that was a dire realization. Moxley said he didn't know whether he was performing well in his matches and segments and didn't care. I started to resent having to go to work, Moxley said. I was like, if I could just stay home and fucking figure this out on my own, if I could just lock myself in a room, I could figure this out. But I have to keep going back on the road, back on a fucking plane. I couldn't get out of it. Renee Paquette remembers a morning last October when Moxley returned from a wrestling show already intoxicated from drinking on a plane ride. This is the Wrestling Revolver show that we referenced before. I was like, holy shit, I've been waiting for you to get home so I can pass the baby off to you so I can go and do my thing, Paquette says. And he had to go sleep because he wasn't feeling well. His body was sore. That's when Paquette knew things had escalated with her husband's drinking to a no longer manageable degree. She talked to her father about the situation, then reached out to Eddie Kingston, AEW executive Mega Parekh, and AEW president Tony Khan. Paquette said that she mainly was met with surprise by those in AEW. Few had noticed what was going on. Moxley wasn't exhibiting any significant warning signs like getting into trouble while drunk or causing a commotion. When he's drinking, he's fun to be around. He's always in a good mood, Paquette says. He's never the guy who you see turns into a mean drunk or wants to get behind the wheel. He would just want to drink and fall asleep. Paquette didn't know how to broach the topic of rehab with Moxley directly. Kingston, she said, was a good sounding board. I told her, he has a baby girl now, he has you, he has to get help right away, Kingston said. That was it. It was nothing like, oh, he's got this wrestling thing coming up, maybe he should wait. Nah, fuck that, get him help now. So, very similar to what was said on the podcast, but kind of goes into a little bit more detail about Renee's involvement, I suppose, and really how much she knew and how much it was affecting her life at the time as well. Interesting, Brandon, to hear Eddie Kingston was quite involved in this. Obviously, we know he's got very outspoken in his own way about mental health. The Players Tribune article that he wrote was a really, really good read. But Eddie Kingston kind of sounds like that kind of guy that we would all want as our best friend, right?
Oh yeah, he's a total right. He's the right hand man that you want and you need in your life if you're going through some dark times. Like, this guy is like not only a good friend, but he's like a sponsor, like rehab sponsor, like basically, like just like he cares like deeply for this man and his wife and Renee and hoping for the best. It's remarkable, like what this what Eddie Kingston brings to the table at large in life. If he's in your corner, it's special.
So I guess back to the actual episode, because it is long. You did hear quite a lot of it at the start, or at least the key takeaways. But basically, the rundown is: he says he wanted to quit, he just couldn't stop. Going to rehab wasn't him giving up. It was more that he was just changing his strategy. He said it was like going 12 rounds with a boxer every day, but you just keep getting your ass kicked and you cannot win. You will never win. He said going to rehab wasn't tapping out, but rather he was getting off the stool with a different strategy. Now he's going to rehab, he says. This is how we're going to win this fight. And he did, but he just had to change his strategy. Martin, is this, I mean, I know he credits kind of someone else for sort of coming up with that, but I mean, isn't this just the most John Moxley way of kind of putting tackling alcohol dependency and going to rehab?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's like, he's obviously so determined, and just the way he's like, right. And you hear it in, like, when he talks about other things that he does, especially, you know, reading his book and then other podcasts he's done talking about other things. It's just like, well, right, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do it like this and that's going to be that sort of thing. It's very sort of matter of fact the way he deals with everything.
It's very poetic as well. Like, I know some people who like to use, say things in this kind of fancy way to sort of be poetic about things. Never sounds good. Definitely nowhere near as good as John Moxley. And again, even his return promo is some of the most interesting backwards kind of mentality that works really, really well. We will obviously get there. But just to move on, because at the start, again, the cold open that we had, the 20-minute piece, Big Cass is actually featured in this. And you might be wondering, why is Big Cass featured in this? Also known as Big Bill at the moment in AEW, or Kaz XL as he was in the Indies, or W. Morrissey as he was in Impact, sorry.
Or W.H. Morrissey.
Or W.H. Morrissey, as you refer to him as. He's obviously referenced by Moxley. And the reason I wanted to bring it up is just because a part of me feels like John Moxley would not have really known, just like you and I, Martin, that this could happen to you without seeing it happen to Big Cass. Because for what I didn't know until I started researching this episode is that Big Cass and John Moxley, they're boys. They go way back. Martin, did you know that the two of them roomed together in FCW in 2012 to 2014?
I didn't until sort of like doing research for one of the other episodes we did, when obviously he talks a lot about it in some other podcasts about them being roommates. But yeah, not until sort of like recently, I didn't realize they were roommates.
So Big Cass called it the best time of his life. And there's another tweet, which I don't have in front of me, but it was by Joey Janela after, you know, the news came out that Mox is going into rehab. Joey Janela said, you know, some of the stuff that John's done for, you know, the smaller guys in the industry is stuff of legend. Obviously, those are things that, you know, don't get mentioned, you know, keep it quiet kind of things. But, you know, I'd imagine that Mox, he would be going up to the main roster in 2014, which is kind of when he stopped being roommates with Cass. But I'm sure he, you know, is quite fond of W. Morrissey. You know, Big Cass would obviously be in NXT for a lot longer and then would come up to the main roster and would have behavioral issues in WWE that would lead to his release. And I think Moxley still had very much a soft spot for him that entire time. After Big Cass was released, Moxley did have some indie matches with him as well, probably, you know, more as a favor more than anything. And yeah, this was something that the two of them kind of have in common now, I suppose. So here is just a little bit about Big Cass, because for people who don't know what happened, here it is, a short clip.
Just the amount that I was drinking was ridiculous. The food I was putting in my body was ridiculous. No physical activity. Chain smoking cigarettes. Like I said, the amount of alcohol I was putting into my body on certain days, I don't know how I'm alive right now. When you're making mistakes like that, you gotta go. Boy, they had every right in the world to get rid of me. And then I went to do that House of Hardcore show in Philadelphia. At that point in time, going into the show, I hadn't slept in 2 days. Two full days. And now people say I haven't slept in 2 days, and they've slept like an hour here and there. No, I literally mean I didn't sleep a second in 2 days. Don't remember walking out through the curtain. Don't remember going to the autograph table. Came to in the ambulance. And they told me you had a seizure. I was like, what the f***? A seizure? I'm not epileptic. I've never had any issues with that. I could have died that night. That's what I was told in the ER.
So again, another story of somebody really not knowing what could happen if you stopped drinking. And he was drinking a lot. He knows he was drinking a lot, and probably just didn't know that if he stopped, that he was going to have a seizure. He thought, "What? I'm epileptic now." You know, so very much, you know, seeing common sort of themes amongst this not really being something that is widely known. So yeah, December 8th, 2018, Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore. He has a seizure at the merchandise table during the intermission of the show. I mentioned that they, him and Moxley, roomed together. In the opener of this show, he did say that he had several more seizures in private. So it was a very, very long battle for Big Cass. And but in April 2022. As a member of the Impact Wrestling roster, he returned to the ECW arena for the very first time at a TV taping, and this is what he had to say.
Damn, it feels good to be back in this arena. And it feels even better to be back in this arena on my terms. Because the last time I was here, I was not in control. I was taken out by EMTs in an ambulance. I was at the lowest point in my entire life. I had hit rock bottom and I had nowhere to go. And nobody to go to. But tonight, I come back here clean, sober. Come back here clean, sober, in the very best damn shape of my life. And for the very first time in my entire life, I can finally admit after 34 years that I am not alone. And that is because of all of you. So thank you for continuing to show me support.
Brandon, I know that in the past you haven't been a big Cass fan, but will you maybe look at Big Bill and AEW a little differently after maybe going through all this stuff?
Oh, I'm a fan of Big Bill's run in AEW now. Like I think he's been awesome with Ricky Starks. Total respect for him and going clean and addressing the crowd at Impact about his struggles and whatnot. Oh, I total respect to him now. I wasn't a fan of his in WWE. The whole Daniel Bryan stuff and whatnot. It was, and his gear sucked too, by the way. I respect the run that he was on now. Now that they're gone, they're off TV now. Where'd they go? But the Big Bill run is much respected. I thought they were chanting for the singer Morrissey for a second in Impact, but they weren't.
Is he big in Philadelphia? You tell us.
The Morrissey's big everywhere, right? Anyway, exactly. But much respect to Big Bill.
You know, Martin, and I guess it's sort of a similar kind of question, but I don't really know, did you really even see much of Big Cass in the WWE and in Impact? Or what did you think of him kind of coming into AEW?
Yeah, I'd heard that he was, I'd seen a lot of him in WWE and I'd seen bits and bobs of him in Impact, but I'd heard he was coming into AEW and I was like, oh, well, I've heard that he's doing a lot better now he's in Impact. I'd not really seen it myself, but yeah, like Brandon said, he's been on a great run, hasn't he, since he's been in AEW. And but going back to the clips of him, I got so much more respect for him watching him. I mean, he is like the, when you think, the stereotypical sort of like macho man sort of thing, this big dude who, just goes in there and kicks ass and everything. And just seeing him just be so vulnerable. Obviously, I watched an extended version of some of those clips you played, and just seeing him be so vulnerable and so open and so honest about, his issues. And I could see him being quite an inspiration for a lot of people watching that, and people perhaps being in the same, the same state that, he's not too sort of quote unquote manly to talk about this stuff. So you don't have to be as well.
Yeah. And in that clip that I just played, when he said he's come back clean, sober, there's a break. The crowd is going wild. What you don't see is obviously because it's just the audio. He does get visibly emotional over this and same sort of thing in quite a lot of his videos, And to me, it really shows a side of him, that, yeah, he's the big macho man, but he definitely has this kind of kind side, as you can see. So, I'm like you, both of you guys. Wasn't a big fan in WWE. Never really saw anything in Impact. I just don't really watch. But by the time he came into AEW, I had already done a lot of this stuff for the documentary I was working on, and I don't know. I was really proud. I was proud that they gave him a chance. And, a big part of me thinks, Mox probably put in a really good word for him. And, at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned, which is, sometimes just having standard good relationships with people can really save your ass in the end. He did a lot of the heavy work, cleaning himself up, getting sober. I don't think he'll ever drink again or ever feel the need to. But then it was tapping into those relationships that he had. He was obviously close to Renee as well. And yeah, they welcomed him with open arms. And I mean, he's in great shape too. I mean, you know, you want a big guy who feels like he owes wrestling his life at this point. Go with Big Bill, because he'll probably work extra hard just for you. So hold on to him, Tony Khan. So that is the in rehab portion of the show. We're at the end now, which is John Moxley coming back. So on the and this is quite crazy. I'm glad I kind of have all this timeline, because out of nowhere, on the 15th of January 2022, GCW just tweets that Moxley will be wrestling Homicide on January 23rd at the Hammerstein Ballroom for the GCW title. I'm sure Tony Khan did not appreciate this, because they got the scoop, I guess, or I don't know. Doesn't really matter in the end, I suppose. Everyone's just happy to see this. But do you remember this happening, or was the AEW return the first that you heard him coming back, Brandon?
You know, I vaguely remember the announcement, but didn't Moxley have the belt for like an exorbitant amount of time, even while he was in rehab, and they didn't know what to do, whether for him to drop the belt, or am I putting two things together?
No, you're absolutely right. And we touched on it on our first episode against Nick Gage, right, that I thought that maybe this Hammerstein Ballroom show, because it was touted as like the big thing for GCW, was going to be that match against Nick Gage. But obviously it probably wasn't a good idea having that as the match if there's a no build, because you know he's been in rehab and absolutely he should be in rehab, but you know, maybe it's just better to push that back and just come back on what would be a, I don't want to say an easy match, but like a, you know, pretty straightforward match with somebody that he knows and there's not really too much expectation. So yes, he was GCW champion through that entire period. And then on the 18th of January, so 3 days later, AEW tweets that Moxley would be returning to AEW Dynamite the following evening. So I don't know, we're all obviously happy that he's coming back. Not really sure what to expect. But this man comes out on TV and he delivers what I can only describe as probably the best promo that I've ever seen or ever heard in my life. So here is John Moxley, first appearance on Dynamite after coming out of rehab.
A little while ago, hey, go yourself. Get that guy out of here. Piece of shit.
Well, he ain't changed much.
It was a little while ago I fell asleep on a plane. We landed, I don't even know what city it was in. And when we hit the ground, I woke up out of a dream. It was a bad dream. And I don't remember everything about it, but I remember I was on the side of the road. I was on my hands and knees in the dirt. My face is bruised and cut up, and there's a black cloud hanging over me. A demon. Kind of demon that follows you around your whole life. Kind of demon that follows you around for years. These demons come in all shapes and sizes for everybody. And this cloud, he's laughing at me. He says, you, everything that you are, everything you become, everything you have in your life that's good, none of that was supposed to happen. None of that belongs to you. Where do you get off thinking you were going to make out with all that in the cloud, this demon? He asked me, he says, do you really think you were going to make it out? The nerve of you, did you really think you were going to make it out? And I woke up before I had a chance to answer him. Nobody gets through life unscathed. We all carry scars. I have more scars on my body than the average person, but those aren't important. The important ones are the scars we carry on the inside that are harder to see. And sometimes we try and cover up these scars. Sometimes we try to pretend these scars aren't there. But those are the scars that we should be proud of. Those are the scars that tell our story. Those are the scars that give us strength. Those are the scars that make us the people we are. Well, nobody's perfect, all right? If everybody was perfect, the world would be a very boring place. So nobody, no matter who you are, should be afraid to stand up in front of the whole world and bear it all. Everything that makes you the person that you are, scars it all, and say, hey, this is me. So, that being said, I'm sure there are plenty of people somewhere around the world. I'm sure there are plenty of people who want to write me off. I'm sure there are plenty of people who doubt me. And you know what? It won't be the first time. It won't be the last time. But if you want to write me off now, if you want to doubt me, you go ahead and say whatever you want to say. You go ahead and think whatever you want to think. I'll tell you the same thing I would have told that black demon, that cloud hanging over me in my dream. You can take all that shit and shove it right up your ass. I don't run from demons. I just beat the shit out of them. And for everybody in this building and for everybody all around the world that's had my back, that supported me through thick and thin, thank you. And buckle up and get ready, because we're going on a ride, baby. In the year of 2022, I am going on a pilgrimage. I'm going to grab the world of professional wrestling by the balls and do whatever the hell I want, because now, more than ever, more than anybody in this business, I am truly free. I'll tell you this, I've been to hell. I wouldn't recommend it, but it is very, very liberating. There is no hell that can be put upon me in this ring that I haven't been through, and worse. So if there's anybody in AEW, anybody all around the world that thinks they can put me through more hell than I've already been through, know this. I'm thirsty. You thought I was dangerous before. Shit. These days, all I drink is blood!
Wow. Tremendous honesty. And no defending Mox.
And how great is it to have that man, John Moxley, back here in All Elite Wrestling?
Martin, I'm going to throw it over to you because... just tell me your thoughts on this promo.
Oh, well, it's like you said, it's one of the best promos of all time. Irrelevant of whether you're a fan of Moxley or not, that is just that, like, transcends wrestling for me. It's just, and this is why we love him so much, just the way he comes out there and just the whole thing how the crowd are so behind him, and then just everything he says in it, the fact, you know, telling the story about, you know, being on the plane and the cloud of the demon on top of him, and then being able to sort of like finally break out and say, you know, you shouldn't be afraid of saying who you are, and that message could, you know, resonate to everybody. Obviously he's specifically talking about, you know, his battles and, you know, his quote-unquote demons, but, you know, that message that he's saying out there in that promo could resonate with absolutely anybody.
Brandon, what did you think of this?
It's just raw and uncut, man. It's just like just showing the bare bones of the man that he is. He was just honest and to the point. It was pretty metal of him to the way he expressed himself too, and what he was going to do and what he is doing for his pilgrimage that he called it. And drinking blood and just embracing the chaos. embracing the suck that he went through to where he is now. It's incredible. Except for that one fan who he was the only dickhead that didn't enjoy him coming back. But other than that, it's incredible. It's one of the best promos I've ever seen.
Hey, it's a bit of a hot topic at the moment. You know, people pay to a wrestling fan can boo who they want kind of thing. For clarification, the fan said, get a garbage truck and get this piece of garbage out of the ring. I know there was a bit of confusion at the time, thinking that somebody said, get this drunk piece of shit out of the ring or something like that. But that's not what happened. So that fan was not completely over the line. But I guess, hey, if Dave Meltzer says wrestling fans can boo whoever they want, maybe wrestlers can tell whoever they want in the crowd to go fuck themselves. I don't know. Maybe it works both ways, right?
There's a time and a place.
Yeah, and that's true as well. You know, I don't really have too many thoughts on the matter, but I just thought it was also just the best way for him to start off his promo as well, telling somebody to go fuck themselves and then deliver what is, quite frankly, just the best all-time promo in my opinion. Low-key, my favorite part of it, one of my favorite parts of it, is when he looks into the camera and he says, in a very seductive way, I'm thirsty. And you hear the high-pitched screams in the crowd. The women, they like that line a lot. And I just, every time I hear it, it pops me, because I'm like, even, hey, if I was in there, I shouldn't say just women, because I may have given a high-pitched scream as well. But yeah, I mean, if anyone's seen the promo video that I made for Eagles Don't Hunt Flies back in October to launch the series, you know, I used this promo. There is no other promo that I could have used in my opinion, just because this one just tops it all. When I heard this, it was, you know, that's when it cemented me for me that he was my favorite wrestler, because as people know, when he left WWE, I didn't think much of him. You know, obviously he built his way back up and I immediately became a fan, you know, after his run in New Japan and the G1, and then coming into AEW. But it really is at this point that I felt for the rest of my life, pretty sure that anybody asks me who my favorite wrestler is, it's going to be John Moxley. And it's kind of like, it's sort of therapeutic for me, because if anybody wants to know, like, why am I on this podcast? When you asked me to participate in this podcast, if you'd asked me about any other wrestler, like, genuinely, as much as I want to do a podcast with you, because I love hearing your voice and you know, both of you are very good friends of mine, I probably would have said no, because I'm like, what have I got to really talk about? But it is at this point that really just transformed me into a super mega fan. And obviously I then would begin to do this documentary, and I just found out so much more about this individual. So, you know, a real moment in time for me as well. But yeah, we all have scars. Just some of the greatest stuff. I listen to it over and over again.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I'm exactly the same with that, you know, cementing my fandom of him. And also, you know, like you said, just listen to it over and over again. It's such a brilliant promo.
So while it was believed that Moxley's first match back would be that GCW match at Hammerstone Ballroom, you know, Tony Khan still gets in there, and it is announced at the end of that Dynamite that John Moxley returned that he would be wrestling Ethan Page on a rare live edition of Rampage. So it did actually take place on the Friday, 21st of January. But before we get to that match, Bully Ray said some really dumb stuff. I'm not going to go through it because I think we all kind of know he said, you know, that he felt Moxley should have apologized. And the only reason I bring it up is because of all the people that thought it was a really dumb take, Jim Cornette was one of those people as well. So, you know, you're fucked up when Jim Cornette tells you that you had a bad take. So let's get on to John Moxley versus Ethan Page. But before we talk about the match, a mere hour before this show was broadcast, an episode of WWE Friday Night SmackDown was going on, and a promo between two people who John Moxley used to be very close with in WWE, Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns. And this is what was said.
The longest reigning SmackDown Tag Team Champions in history, the Usos, who in truth, and you know it, they're the cornerstones of your bloodline. They're the ones who make everything you do possible. They're the ones who hold you up, just like me and Mox did in the Shield. The Usos are your pedestal.
I remember watching this live and going, wait, what did he just say? Because that's not the name that he obviously had at the time. And you know, there's a certain 70-year-old man backstage who probably didn't appreciate that, but clearly felt like he didn't give a damn. And just to back this up, which is really interesting, because somebody asked him about this in an interview. It's so funny. He said, I wasn't going to ignore history, saying that people might not remember that there was a third person in the Shield or the Shield at all, almost pretending. And he was basically almost pretending like he actually said Ambrose, ignoring the fact that he actually said Mox. He never addressed the fact that he said Mox, not Ambrose. But he gave the indication in this interview that he did not clear this at all. And he just went ahead and said it. So a lot of support and love in very different ways all throughout the wrestling world. So let's talk about this match. Really a nothing match, if I'm being honest. And I do apologize to people who thought we might be reviewing good wrestling matches on this show, but not so much.
The Moxley road back is it doesn't get to the good matches yet.
I will run through them very quickly. But it's almost like for this episode, we should refer to the crap ones, because the good ones, I think, will have their own, you know, episodes in future. But obviously, the most noticeable thing was how he looked. We noticed it in his return promo, but he was wearing jacket, shirt and all that. Now he's just wearing the pants, and oh my God, he looks tiny, like scary tiny.
Oh yeah, and if you watch those two matches back to back, the one that we talked about at the start, you know, the one prior to rehab, and then this one, he does look really tiny, especially even up against Ethan Page, who's, you know, he's not the biggest guy in the world either, and you know, Moxley looks like a little kid next to him, doesn't he?
Yeah, and so it is interesting, because everyone's like, he looks really lean and all that sort of stuff. And he'll tell you, like, he thought he looked like shit. And, well, the reason is because, you know, he's been stuck in a room for the last 3 months, and he's not really been working out and all that sort of stuff. So he's not in the shape that he wants to be. And like I said before, the 2024 Mox that we see now very much is, you know, the Mox. So, anyway, very basic match, chop exchange. They go back and forth. I wrote here, Moxley bites Page's head. Good to see him back. It was, but this is the thing. Like, it was so much different than the one against 10. This one felt a little bit more like, classic Moxley. Whereas the one against 10, it was kind of like, oh, geez, man, are you all right? Like, you look like you're actually trying to eat him. Brawling on the outside, very standard stuff. Commentary constantly talking about Moxley not being the same as before, kind of almost recognizing that there might be something a little off. Maybe John sort of talked to them prior to the show that he wasn't feeling the greatest or something, but it continued to come up on commentary. Come back from commercial page.
This match reminded me how awful Jericho was on commentary. Rewatching this match reminded me just how terrible Jericho was on commentary.
Oh, man. 100%. As a Rampage fan, he is the third ring of hell of announcers.
But this was a Ring of Hell itself. There were four people on commentary. Ricky Starks just starts talking after a while. I'm like, oh, okay, he's here as well. All right.
That's right. This is the era of AEW where we're going to have like six panelists calling matches like it's Naked Gun 2 in the Dodger Stadium.
So we come back from commercial. Paige has Mox up in the Ego's Edge when Mox escapes, gives him a couple of Germans, then a third. Mox fires up, but is still very flat. Like the crowd's very flat. Everything's kind of flat. Continues on offense. Crowd starts to get into it a little bit. He gets cut off. Starts selling the knee, which Paige targets. Back and forth, Paige gives Mox an avalanche power slam. But while on the ground, Mox gives Paige the elbows and the knees to the face before locking in the bulldog choke. And Paige goes out in 10 minutes and 15 seconds. Brandon, what do you think of this match?
I mean, it was what it was. It was a match, but it's good. It was good to see the vampire John Moxley back in action and whatnot. But yeah, he looked a little rusty, but no worse wear. He's got some more work to do before he gets back to the road of damnation.
What was interesting about this match is that Ethan Page is on top for most of it, which you don't really get with that many Moxley matches. But Ethan Page is like, you know, dominating Moxley for like quite a lot of this match. But I suppose, like Brandon said, it's just a match, and like you said, parts of it are really flat. But the main thing is Mox getting back into wrestling, you know, after this big time off. You know, it's been a big sort of like shock to the system in his life and his lifestyle, and you know, he's coming back sort of, you know, not a totally different person, but kind of a different person. So it's just that sort of like road back to sort of like getting him to be how he wants. But I suppose the main thing is just the seeing how he looks. And like we said before, we're not shaming anybody, but it's just the two contrasting styles in the way he looks prior to rehab and then him coming out again. And obviously commentary are constantly reminding you about it as well.
Here's what John Moxley said about his return match.
When I first wrestled again, so I came back in January, and it was weird. Like, just being in the ring was weird. It felt strange. Like, I came back and did a promo, and that felt great because I didn't have to do anything physical. I just got to talk. But I was, like, super relaxed, like, as if I was just talking. I was more relaxed there than I am now, really, sitting in this seat. So my first match back, you think it's just going to be like, oh, okay, well, now you're sober, so you're just going to feel like $1 million. But it doesn't really work like that. And like, I was weird. It was like my legs were in quicksand. I didn't have any adrenaline. Not that I didn't have any adrenaline so much as like I wasn't nervous or like, and it's hard to put into words, but it used to be like this big, long, giant process to get ready to go out and do a match or wrestle. It's like this transformation to be ready to go to the ring.
Yeah.
It's like this long process of getting it to warming up and feeling better and pouring water on your head and hydrating or whatever to like transform from like how you woke up in the morning to like being in the main event that night is like this. And I think people who probably don't, spend their lives, you know, like partying too much or whatever, probably like don't realize or probably take for granted just waking up in the morning and feeling good.
Right.
Because to me, it's like still almost like I feel like I'm cheating. Mm-hmm. Like the novelty hasn't fully worn off.
Of like not having a hangover?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like waking up and being like, okay. Like I don't have to worry about like being massively dehydrated or, you know, feeling like crap or whatever. Like for me, it's almost like, oh, I got like a cheat code or something, you know? Anyway, but like that first match, I felt terrible. Like I just felt like off. Like it was weird. Mm-hmm. I can't really explain it. Like I was just like chemically imbalanced and like it was strange. And then like got little better the next match and the next match. I finally wrestled Brian at a pay-per-view. And we more or less just went to the ring like the first time I ever met him. Just kind of got in the ring and just wrestled. And now, then I kind of started feeling my mojo again.
Yeah.
I was like, but it took me like a month or something.
How much
like,
did that scare you to like have that feeling of like, oh my God, am I going to get back to getting that mojo? Like, who is this new person that I am all of a sudden?
Oh yeah, it was stressful. I was like, oh no, do I suck now? This sucks.
Right, right.
But then I started to very quickly got my mojo back. So it's somewhere in the middle of that match with Brian, I think.
And so we go to, you know, very quickly run through what happened in that match with Brian. Not in the match. I'm sure that'll be another episode. But Brian Danielson in March at AEW Revolution. He then goes on to face Biff Busick at Bloodsport, which is very highly rated. Then the Moxley versus Yuta match that I referenced at the start of the show that I thought was the one that happened before he went to rehab. This was on Rampage. It has a score of 9.13 on Cage Match. Absolutely incredible match, I thought, especially for a Rampage. Then in April, Moxley versus Will Ospreay. Then in April, Moxley versus Tom Lawler at Defy, which was originally scheduled for November 20th and was pushed back to here. Very high rating as well. Then Moxley versus Tanahashi versus Juice Robinson versus Will Ospreay in May. Anarchy in the Arena was also in May with Double or Nothing. Then Moxley versus Daniel Garcia in June. June also Moxley versus Kyle O'Reilly. Then Moxley versus Mike Bailey at Wrestling Revolver also in June. June as well, Moxley versus Tanahashi, where he won the new Interim World Championship. Don't call it Interim, at Forbidden Door. Then Moxley versus Takeshita in July, Moxley versus El Desperado also in July, then Moxley versus Jericho, which we saw the end of with the blood coming out of Moxley's ear. Moxley versus CM Punk in September, which we reviewed, and then Moxley versus Danielson at Grand Slam to become a champion again, and finishing up with MJF dropping the title. It all came to a head at the end, though, because Moxley would, of course, be voted Wrestler of the Year in the 2022 Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards. Martin, 2022, his greatest year so far, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, coming back from that, and you could see he felt like he had a point to prove, maybe not to anybody else, but certainly to, I feel like, himself. And especially listening to that clip where he's talking to Renee, and, you know, he felt like shit coming back and something was off. But, and he just seemed to go on a tear, didn't he? He was having all that brilliant, all those brilliant matches, some great TV matches every week. And yeah, certainly, definitely his best year to date.
Brandon, any of those matches stick out to you as ones you remember more than anything?
The Yuta one was pretty gory. That run that he went on is just like it's like an all time heater, right?
Yeah, and those are just the ones. Those are just the matches, by the way, that were rated above 8. It's probably not even all of them because I just thought I can't read all of this. So like, yeah, it's ridiculous for me. It's like I look at it and I think, man, that I just love that match against El Desperado, a junior heavyweight in New Japan, coming over wrestling in Nashville. It was just a great dynamic hardcore match. You know, they were both in their element, and they would go on to have another match last year, something that I will twist Martin's arm to do a series on, Moxley versus El Desperado, just to go through those matches. But yeah, this would be, I guess, 2022. And then start of 2023 would begin like the Moxley Hangman Page trilogy, the third of those being the death match, which is John Moxley's highest rated singles match on Cage Match at a 9.24, which I think we all just consider as a legendary match. So since this point, John Moxley has gone on to become a pseudo spokesperson for Athletic Brewing Company, which he's referenced quite a bit, gives them lots of shout outs, asked for free stuff. They did in fact send him free stuff. The reason I bring this up is actually because early last month, about this time last month, the Wall Street Journal published an article titled "The Hottest Beer in America Doesn't Have Alcohol." Athletic Brewing is the name of the company, has since become the country's king of non-alcoholic beers, recently passing Heineken and Budweiser as the number one brand by sales in U.S. grocery stores, according to analysis. In fact, at Whole Foods Market, Athletic is now sells more than any other beer, including the ones with alcohol. I have had this beer. It is delicious. I love this. I have become a big fan of non-alcoholic beers, not just because John Moxley drinks it and I'll do anything that man says, but he's not wrong. This particular beer, even though it was expensive, and I don't even think you can get it in Australia anymore, so I'll have to have some next month in Philadelphia, but I cannot think of anything better to drink after, let's say, going out in the yard or something, coming back hot and sweaty and thinking, I can have an alcoholic beer, or I could have something that's much better for me and pretty much just tastes exactly the same, if not better, which is this Athletic Brewing. Yes, so you can sponsor us as well, Athletic Brewing. But, Martin, any experience with non-alcoholic beer? I know you drink beer. You're probably going to have a beer after this. But any non-alcoholic beer take fancy?
The only one I think I've had is Erdinger, which is a German beer, and that was really nice. They do like a good sort of like 0% one. But, if you need somebody to plug you, Wes, then John Moxley's the guy, apparently. I mean, going off those stats that you're reeling out, the best-selling beer in Whole Foods and all that, then, John Moxley is a spokesperson for you. That's fantastic.
Brandon, any experience with non-alcoholic beer?
Yeah, I mean, I've had O'Doul's. it was all right. I mean, that Athletic beer looks, it sounds intriguing, but I'm afraid you're going to go to the Whole Foods and pay some, an arm and a leg and some thighs for like, what do they come in, a six pack?
I don't know. You tell me.
I've never seen it before. I'm going to have to pick one up.
They definitely have them in six packs here, but as I mentioned, you only get six packs or a case of 24. So there's no in between. But I hung out with Chris Leone in 2022, and I picked some up from the King of Prussia grocery store there. It's good stuff. So unfortunately, really, really sad news, because later in the year, on October 20th, Sean Ross Sapp reports that Kevin Nash's son Tristan had passed away, and there wasn't any information past that point. But on a episode of Click This, I believe, Nash would reveal that the cause of death was cardiac arrest from seizure caused by alcohol withdrawal symptoms. So we heard lengthy part of that at the start of the show. He was only 26 years of age. I think it's really important to kind of put that in there, just because it's not like you don't hear the story that much in wrestling of even big Cass having seizures. You know, you obviously hear a lot of people having alcohol issues. They try to get themselves cleaned up. You know, Jeff Jarrett and Jeff Hardy, who, you know, is an ongoing project, obviously. But you don't hear too many about it going too far with alcohol dependency. And unfortunately, with Kevin Nash's son, it went to the point of death, unfortunately. So, just sort of showcasing the series. And kind of crazy that it happened in this year when, you know, I know I already started doing a lot of this documentary, and was kind of almost sort of wrapping things up on this particular episode when this happened. And I just thought, holy shit, you know? So very, very sad. But final thing is, on the 2-year anniversary, just before Moxley entered rehab, he gave an interview with a now defunct news outlet called The Messenger, went out of business earlier this year. He said, "It's fucking hard. it's not the same hell as before, but it's a completely different challenge every single day where you don't know the direction you might go in. I'd love to give you like a positive self-help book type answer or something about fucking sunshine and rainbows and fairies and shit, but that's not the reality. It's been good on the whole. It's been good. I'm the luckiest guy in the world, but you know, you will pay for it on the other side. Your choices you make in life, you fuck up your brain chemistry. It takes a lot of time for your body and the physical damage you've done to yourself to regulate itself. I'm not always the easiest person to be around. I have crazy mood swings and shit like that. Whatever I do, whatever choices I make, Nora is going to see that, or see that eventually as she gets older. Without Renee, I couldn't tell you what my life would be like or what it had ended up like. It's probably the most fortunate thing to ever happen. God knows I could be buried in the desert in Vegas right now. So that's it. Very touching words at the end to kind of wrap this up. And yeah, just sort of putting a bow on really the serious nature of all of this. And it, you don't just go to rehab and kick the habit and it's all sunshine and sorry, what did he say? Sunshine, rainbows and fairies and shit. So Brandon, any yes. final thoughts on this episode?
This is one of the most audacious episodes we've probably done. Serious, it was pretty interesting. Look back on, you know, he's like everybody else in life. We all go through struggles, and we got to find a way to dig out of those struggles. And John Moxley is doing that. And he's also, you know, in the back of his mind saying, you know, we all slip, and hopefully we won't slip and get through these times unscathed. But yeah, it was very cool and different, and I loved it. It was awesome.
Mom?
Yeah, just like Mox noted there at the end, you know, this thing is a day-to-day struggle I completely imagine and completely empathize there. And just real eye-opening, like I've noted already in this episode, just things I didn't know about really educated me on, you know, the sort of like struggles and, you know, all the different stages people can go through tackling alcoholism. And yeah, it's just an absolutely fascinating look. And, you know, and as we record this, you know, such a great story that Mox came out the other end. And, you know, as we talked about, it's 2022, you know, better than ever. So, you know, it was a real good story in that respect that, you know, Moxley came through this. And, you know, he might be struggling with it still to this day, but, you know, he seems to just be improving and getting better and better.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, I think he created a lot of awareness for this, which I think is like probably the best outcome. You know, you want, when something bad happens, you want change to follow it. And it doesn't necessarily need to be, if you've done something bad, you want to change. It doesn't even need to be a person doing something bad. It's just something bad. And then we, even as a society, you know, try to prevent that bad from kind of happening again. And that comes from awareness. And so the man, he doesn't speak a lot, but when he does, it's extremely impactful. I think I've said that a few times already. And I mean, you listen to him on this, you know, how could you not be a bit more mindful about, you know, putting alcohol in your system and being more self-aware with, you know, what is actually going on, like what it is doing to you and what it can ultimately do to you if you take it too far, sort of thing. So my thoughts, you know, like I think I said before, this has been a therapeutic thing for me. I appreciate everybody. Appreciate you guys for letting me sit in the driver's seat for this one, because of course I've had this in my back pocket since the middle of 2022, and even just going through it all and putting it together, putting the documentary together, was very, very emotional for me. I cried so many times, especially when putting in like stuff about Tristan Nash, and sort of being able to kind of close this part off for me. I may decide to do this series sometime in the future, but obviously this won't be one of the episodes. So I'm kind of glad that I sort of got to share it with you guys and everybody listening as well. We promise next month we'll be a bit more lighthearted, even though I have no idea how or what we're going to do next month, because Brandon, I'm going to be in Philadelphia this time next month with you, touching you, feeling you, smelling you, pulling your beard. How do you think about that? Are you excited?
I mean, your beard is bigger than mine, so
I've been working on it.
You're like a garden gnome right now, but yeah, oh, absolutely. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see everybody. It should be fun and plenty of games that week for May Day weekend.
So I think just stay tuned. We haven't 100% figured out exactly what we're going to do, but it might be easier because we'll only be in two different continents. Who knows? But Martin, I don't think we really know exactly what's coming up in the Poison Runner schedule because it is the 1st of March that we were recording this, and the schedule might not have come out. But the guys did just release The Crow, I believe, Up Yours, which is quite good, the parallel with Sting retiring, and of course, Best Match Ever with Sting with Nate Milton. Do you have any other plugs, Martin?
Just for that one, that Best Match Ever with Sting. I mean, that was an absolutely fantastic episode that the three guys did. And, you know, I've been a Sting fan since like the early 90s, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be really hard for me seeing him retire. And, you know, he's given us so many sort of like great moments, memories and matches. And just listening to that was absolutely fantastic. So great work by all three of those. And while we're talking about great work, you've done an absolutely fantastic job on this, mate. I know it's been like sort of a labor of love for you, and you've done absolutely brilliant on it. So like that's off to you. Absolutely fantastic job on this episode.
Thank you, Martin. I just want to say one thing. Yeah, go for it, Brandon.
It's been a great episode, and I just want to bring a little levity to the situation by saying quote the following from an Armenian but an Armenian philosopher, and he quote Mutzemek Menk Bazronek Yank Ish Leoni Menk Sten Du Har Yes Kez Yev Huiz Uem Vor Dusters Kag Gas Muyes Colgan.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Martin, for those words, but never again. I don't know how you do it every single time. But you're back in the driver's seat. For me, chop-tees.com/EaglesDon'tHuntFlies. By the time you're listening to this, there might be a new Eagles Don't Hunt Flies product that you can purchase. I haven't decided what it is yet, but I can put something up very quickly because I own the store. So look out for that. Buy yourself something. Shout out Anne-Marie, who bought a long sleeve Deathmatch Van Gogh shirt yesterday.
What a ride or die. Respect.
Absolutely, 100%.
Oh, and O'Doul's is good non-alcoholic beer if you lived in the 1980s, by the way. But go ahead, continue. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to wrap this up and say, yeah, thanks everybody for listening. Another bumper episode, and we will talk to you next month. Ambrose out.